The negative reaction to Pope John Paul II's document on life-sustaining treatment and the vegetative state was such that after his death in the year 2007, which is 2 years after the Pope had died, it was felt expedient to reiterate the teaching that he had articulated in his papal allocution and to make it clear from the context of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith that what he had said was very much a part of the consistent teaching of the Church and therefore an official magisterial teaching. Part of the reaction and the reason for this statement from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith was the fact that there were two principal lines of attack. One, primarily from the lay press, accused the Catholic tradition of now insisting that all patients, and particularly those who were dying and who would approach the end of their life, would now be, as it were, tortured by Catholic institutions by being forced to have nutrition and hydration, presumably through a nasogastric tube or some other inconvenient or unpleasant modality because of the Pope's teaching. Of course, this is not the case. And even before his death, the Pope had issued a statement on palliative care that made it clear that treatment at the end of life is very different from the context of the persistent vegetative state, which, as we've seen, is someone who is not dying, does not have the physiological or biochemical characteristics of a dying person, and therefore needs to be treated in a very different way. There was this accusation which had been seized upon by the pro-euthanasia lobby, which was now claiming that if you were in a Catholic institution, your death would be terrible and painful, and therefore euthanasia ought to be permitted or encouraged so as to avoid this terrible, torturing tyranny of Catholicism. But there was also another kind of objection, and that was from within the Church, and that was from moral theologians who continued to claim that despite what the Pope had said, it would be morally permissible to withdraw nutrition and hydration from someone who had been determined to be extremely unlikely or that return to consciousness would be essentially impossible. Would it be permissible to stop food and water in someone who a neurologist had declared will never return to consciousness? And those are the two principal things that this statement was intended to address. The one directly, that is addressing moral theologians who were challenging the papal statement, and the other rather indirectly pointing out that the nutrition and hydration requirement is primarily emphasized in the context of the persistent vegetative state, that is, of someone who is not dying. And towards the end of an explanation or a kind of a discussion of this answer also provided by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, there is specific enumeration of circumstances in which it might not be possible or expedient, even in patients in the persistent vegetative state, to provide this. But we'll get to that in a moment. The first question that was asked, or the way the issue was addressed, to ask whether food and water are morally obligatory, except when they cannot be assimilated by the patient's body, or cannot be administered without causing significant physical discomfort. So the nature of the question indicates that it is assumed that if food and water can't be assimilated, that is, at the very end of life, or that if these means can't be employed without causing significant physical discomfort, it's assumed that they would not be used. Now, again, if the patient's unconscious or unable to express themselves, the question of physical discomfort doesn't really arise in the same way that it would with a conscious person who might, as we have seen, experience moral repugnance toward various kinds of treatments, horror vehemens is the technical term, and for whom then even normally required, normally proportionate, or obligatory means would not necessarily be obligatory. So the question is framed not to attempt to contradict, but simply to reassert or presume that older understanding of the right of individuals to refuse that which is morally repugnant, for which they experience a vehement horror. Is it obligatory to use nutrition and hydration for patients in the persistent vegetative state? With those exceptions, and the response is yes. And again, the term is used, taken directly from the papal document, in principle, not absolutely, always, forever, but in principle. Normally, in most circumstances, it is ordinary and proportionate and obligatory to the extent that it is serving the end of hydrating and providing nourishment for the patient. That is to say, this would not apply in the case of someone who was dying. And then the second question, if the person can be judged with moral certainty to be incapable of recovering consciousness, is this a sufficient reason for withdrawing nutrition and hydration? And the answer is no, because the person is not dying, and therefore they should be provided with ordinary and proportionate care, which, again, highlighted in principle, normally, in most circumstances, includes the administration of water and food, even by artificial means, even if this is by a nasogastric tube or, much more commonly today, a gastrostomy tube, a tube that is placed directly through the abdomen into the stomach and therefore does not involve the inconvenience, and if the patient is aware, the pain that would be present, the discomfort that would be there if a nasogastric tube, a tube through the nose into the stomach, were being employed. So, there is a reiteration here of what we've already seen in John Paul II's document, and then if we drop down to the commentary, we can see, and we won't look at this in detail, but I've highlighted a couple of sections. There is an attempt to speak directly to Catholic moral theologians who are using principles articulated by Pius XII to try to justify withdrawing nutrition and hydration for patients in a persistent vegetative state. And there's a specific citation of the principles that the Pope had then in 1957 articulated, that that the duty to receive ordinary means is to receive means that do not impose an extraordinary burden on the patient or on others, and a person is not forbidden to do more than what is obligatory to preserve life and health, as long as one doesn't neglect more important duties. So there is the principle clearly articulated that a person is not required to make use of means that impose an extraordinary burden. However, as the document goes on to point out, patients in a vegetative state simply require nutrition and hydration, which is not an extraordinary burden for them, but can be burdensome for those who care for them. But that's not a legitimate reason for stopping their care. So, if we drop down now towards the very bottom of this document, the text that is highlighted in white that begins, the basic points are two. First of all, the provision of water and food, even by artificial means, is, and again, in principle, and this is always stated because the Church does not want to be in the position, as the euthanasia lobby claims that it is, of saying that nutrition and hydration by artificial means are always required. They are not always required, but for patients in the persistent vegetative state, they are. These people are disabled. They're not capable of obtaining their own nutrition and hydration. They depend on others for their care, and that care must be provided them. However, note toward the very bottom of the document, and this is highlighted in white and in boldface type, the possibility is not excluded that due to emerging complications, a patient may be unable to assimilate food and liquids so that their provision becomes useless. Again, this would primarily be someone who is dying or otherwise very, very severely ill, and their digestive tract simply can't absorb nutrition and hydration, then there's no reason for having an artificial tube feeding. And finally, the possibility is not absolutely excluded that in rare cases, nutrition and hydration may be excessively burdensome for the patient, and the burden is not here defined. It would be physical, or it could be psychological, or could cause significant physical discomfort, for example, resulting from complications in the use of the means employed. So the whole idea of it being in principle required in the persistent vegetative state is not absolute. It's recognized that there are exceptions. But these exceptions should not be used as a means of saying, therefore, we can just generally and feel quite comfortable withdrawing, discontinuing life support, nutrition, and hydration for patients in this condition.